Hello and welcome to Lessons from Loss, the podcast in which we share our experience of loss and, more importantly, what we learn from them that now positively guides our lives today. I'm your host, Rachel Smith, and each episode I chat with a different guest. I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the courage and vulnerability of all my guests in sharing their very personal experiences, and also the impact that hearing about these may have on you, the listener. So please take care as you listen. So today I'm delighted to be chatting with Dr. Caroline Steele. Now, Caroline is a GP who experienced burnout a few years ago, and in her path to healing and recovery, she learned a lot about herself and was also able to draw parallels with her dysfunctional and chaotic childhood family experience and public service workers. Through her work as a coach, Caroline now empowers women in healthcare roles to make that elusive work-life balance a real thing and recognise and hopefully prevent burnout. So welcome, Caroline. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
You're very welcome. So firstly, to sort of acknowledge your recovery from burnout, and it seems that sadly that's now a real common occurrence, particularly within the healthcare sector. And the work that you now do as a coach is really important to help others recognise and hopefully prevent burnout for themselves. So perhaps we can start there with how was that experience of burnout for you, and what did you learn from it?
Okay, yeah, it all feels very long ago now, and it's difficult to tap back into how I felt. But I burnt out in 2019, just after Christmas, and essentially, looking back, it had been coming for a really, really long time. I had been sort of crawling to my next annual leave, my next weekend, my next day off. The period of time I was trying to get to getting shorter and shorter and shorter all the time. And then just after Christmas, essentially, I hit a wall and couldn't go to work. Couldn't stop crying for a start, which was very unusual for me. We're not a crying family, as we'll probably touch on later. Emotion in my family was generally discouraged. So basically, I tell the story of my burnout as being about potatoes. I can vividly remember standing in the kitchen on Christmas Day with a bag of potatoes in my hands. I can hear the kids playing. I can hear my father-in-law chatting. The room is kind of warm and steamy, and I can smell the turkey. And I know I should be able to smell the potatoes roasting as well, but I literally couldn't force my brain to decide how many potatoes to peel. It felt like life and death, which, as you can imagine, I've been in life and death situations. I've made life and death decisions. I now know, obviously, this wasn't one. It didn't really matter how many potatoes there were. But at that time, it just felt overwhelming. And interesting, the more people I talk to about burnout, the more I discover that's quite a common pattern. It will be something really, really tiny that when you're well is completely inconsequential, that feels like this kind of enormous decision that's impossible to make. So potato gate happened. I had a big fight with my husband, realized I was going to end up in a bedsit on my own and the kids would go live with him instead of me because I was so miserable all the time. I was going to lose my career, lose my identity as a GP, which obviously had been, I decided when I was nine I wanted to be a doctor, so it had been my identity for a really long time. Mm. Everything felt like it was falling apart. So the next working day after Christmas, I went to work to tell them I couldn't come to work because that's how my brain was functioning at that point. Had fantastic support from my practice, fantastic support from my GP, and took 2 months off. Did a lot of work with a therapist and with coaches, and thought essentially, so I rang my GP and he said, oh, you know, just come straight in, which was really nice of him. Come straight in. The time I arrived was definitely coffee time because the whole place was empty and nobody else was doing any work. which I really appreciated. And I kind of thought, as I was driving there, I thought, yeah, I'm going to ask for a week off. A week would be reasonable. Maybe two is too, a bit greedy. And I sort of walked in the door and he said, right, you're burned out. You're having your month off. And then we'll meet again. And it really felt like, that whole cliche of the weight lifting off your shoulders. It really, really felt like that. It felt like for any other healthcare professionals who know what this is like, it's like when you've been wearing a lead apron for sort of x-rays for a while and you take it off and you just feel kind of lighter and everything. Just not to have to make that decision, not to have to bargain even with myself for how long I really needed.
And I guess having someone recognize and acknowledge actually how how burnt out that you were.
Because I think that, yeah, that's a really good point. Because I'd done some, well, I mean, the burnout was well recognized as a thing at that point, and there was burnout training from the Royal College of GPs and burnout recognition questionnaires and things, but everybody was in the same boat. So you'd kind of, you'd do a questionnaire and you'd talk to your friends about what you replied, and they'd tick the same boxes. So you'd kind of think, oh, well, okay, this is just how it is. Everyone else is coping. There must be something wrong with me. I just need to work harder. So yeah, having that recognition, having someone else take a bit of responsibility from me was huge. And essentially, I put myself to bed for 2 weeks. I literally only got out of bed to take the kids to school, and otherwise, I just kind of laid there staring at the wall. My therapist called it defragging, which I thought was really helpful, just letting my brain do what it needed to do.
It's not, must have been helpful to have had that explanation in a way, so that it kind of makes it that actually that's a perfectly normal response for where you were at. That actually, yeah, your brain just needed to defrag,
Yeah,
as all
absolutely.
computers do every now and again.
Yeah, to properly switch off and switch back on again, which I don't think I've actually done for my brain for ages. So that was really helpful. Then in a month in, I went back to my GP and he said, right, I don't want you to go back until you want to go back. And I kind of thought, oh, well, that's never going to happen. Why would I want to get back into, because I was starting to realize at that point how much better I felt. Not having to think about going to work, not having the messages every day saying, can you cover an extra shift? Can you, someone's off sick, can you do this? Can you do this? All this paperwork, and these, none of that. It all just went away. I thought, gosh, why would I want to get back in that boiling pot of water? Which had been my fear about the idea of taking sick leave before. So when I'd done these burnout questionnaires and they said, oh yeah, you're at high risk, I was like, well, if I get out, I'm not going to want to come back. Which was very much how I felt. So I started to look for something else I could do. I was pretty sure doctoring wasn't it. I did obstetrics and gynecology before I went into general practice. I thought obstetrics and gynecology was what I wanted to do, found out it wasn't. General practice was kind of my last throw at the dice of being a doctor, and that had been what, 15 years before. So it kind of felt like, well, there's nothing else I want to do in this arena. So that was really hard. Interestingly, one of the things that I've discovered in looking at the kind of childhood I had, so essentially both of my parents, but my mum in particular, were very emotionally immature. And there's a fantastic book that I'm sure we'll come on to talk about, written by a psychologist about adult children of emotionally immature parents. And one of the things that she talks about is that both emotionally immature parents and their children learn as a way of coping, learn to really identify with roles. So the role of doctor was a really big deal. It was a lot of how I identified myself. And one of the first questions my therapist asked was, who are you without your role? So when you're not being mum or wife or doctor, and I just didn't know.
We attach so much importance, don't we, to those roles, and when they get
Absolutely.
taken away or loss, whether that's voluntarily or otherwise.
Yeah, so even the threat of the loss of that role was really, really frightening. I can remember feeling like, this is going to sound a bit daft, but this is what it felt like. Felt like a burlesque, the burlesque dancers who have all the balloons and they pop them as they dance.
Yeah.
It felt like I was going to pop the balloon that said doctor and the one that said mother and the one that said wife, and there'd be just nothing. I'd just be legs and a head, and there'd be nothing in the middle. That's how it felt.
Yes. Yeah. It was quite scary.
It was very, it was really scary. So I guess the story of my burnout recovery has essentially been the story of refinding myself, reacquainting myself with all those bits of me that I'd been put away and hidden and put in a box for various reasons. So partly to do with work, I think, there are certain expectations of doctors. Some of them we put on ourselves, some of them are reasonable expectations, that the public and the profession put on us. But the bits that don't fit get kind of lost along the way.
And do you think that that happened as early on as when you were doing your training? Because, even those people who aren't in healthcare, I think we kind of all acknowledge that the training that medical professionals go through is pretty full on and very much, it would seem from the outside, almost like an initiation test that if you can get through that, then actually there's a good chance you're going to be able to deal with what gets thrown at you once you are qualified. So do you think that, those parts of you that you put away in boxes, that was happening right back then?
I do. I mean, I think it was happening even before then, to be honest. I think there are, or there certainly were, even expectations of the kind of student you had to be at school to be someone applying to medical school.
Yeah, of course.
So there were, you're expected to do really well in exams, but you're also expected to be, broad and volunteering and playing an instrument and having leadership roles and all that sort of thing. So really it starts incredibly early. The bits that don't fit in that pattern aren't for public consumption, I guess. And interestingly, coming from my family, I think for me it started even earlier than that. There were parts of me that were not acceptable to my family, to my mum. Particularly, so things like nobody was allowed to disagree with her, it was her way or the highway. And it just was became it was easier not to disagree than to suffer the fallout, essentially. There were things that I wanted to do that I didn't bother to ask because, again, it wasn't worth the fallout of asking. She took any kind of dissenting opinion, and even a very mild disagreement was she felt was an attack on her, which is quite common. I think emotionally immature parents often are very binary, and they're very self-protective, so they have to be the good guy. And if you disagree with them, that self-concept as the person who's right and good gets threatened a bit. So from a really early age, the way I coped with that, so there's two different ways of coping with that generally in the literature. The one is to kind of put your head down, shut yourself off, chop off the bits of you that aren't suitable, anything for a quiet life. And then the other way is, so that's sort of known as internalizer. And then the other way is to be an externalizer and to be kind of, no, I'm gonna fight with everything I've got, and you can't ignore me, and I'll make you give me attention, I'll make you notice me. Which interestingly is the way my middle sister went. And for a long time, she couldn't understand why I was so willing to put up with stuff, and I couldn't understand why she couldn't just, sit and survive. So I think I've been putting bits of myself in a box for a really, really, really long time. And opening the boxes was, re and particularly opening them and sharing them with people was incredibly scary. Incredibly made me feel incredibly vulnerable.
And did that start with sharing with your therapist and then went sort of
Yeah.
wider to friends and family?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I found my therapist was fantastic. And I went every week for a while, and every week I think I've got nothing to say. I don't know what we're going to talk about. And then I'd get there, wow, and stuff. Just, yeah, stuff that I'd never shared with anybody. She was, yeah, magic. And it's
It's
so,
wonderful, isn't it, when you
oh,
find
it's
a therapist like that, that, and I suppose because you were probably aware that you were heading to burnout, but you've just got to get on and deal with it because all your friends and colleagues were all just seemingly getting on and dealing with it. And then you just sort of shut those other things away, even sort of tightly pack them in even more, don't you? So that actually when you do have that opportunity to speak, initially it just feels, well, that's just little stuff. It doesn't really matter. But then when you do get the opportunity to start talking about them, actually they can be really quite, or certainly in my experience, really quite fundamental things that we push away that are sort of key to our well-being and who we are.
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it was so nice just to, I think because I was so used to feeling like people's response to things my mum had done and things that had happened was like, well, that's, you know, I'd often get, and my sister is the same, oh, but she's your mum. Oh, but she means well. And you'd be like, I don't think she does. Or, oh, but she probably didn't mean to do that. Like, for instance, this is going to sound like a really small petty thing, but it really wasn't. She would send birthday presents through Amazon to my kids, and Christmas presents, and something would be wrong on the address every time. Different thing for each thing. So it's not like she'd put it into Amazon wrong, and just hadn't it hadn't corrected. And you say that to other people, and they'd be like, oh, she just made a mistake. Like, nobody makes a different mistake on every single
Everything.
parcel they send. So it would be those kind of just these little tiny kind of jabs. And it was really nice to have my therapist kind of not go, oh, but that's, you know, that's nothing. Obviously not, because that's, you know, her job. But to kind of, okay, and what else? And what else? And what else? And uncover these patterns going back decades, going back through my whole life, really. And then you can start to see the same emotional patterns in the way that you respond to a slightly belittling comment from your consultant or a nurse being unpleasant to you because they're also at burnout, or you know, yeah. And it's really, once you start to see these patterns, they're everywhere, and it's really, really interesting.
Have you been able, so by recognizing those patterns, are you, or have you been able to, has that made a difference in perhaps the way that you've responded to situations?
Yeah, hugely, hugely. So yeah, I mean, essentially I retrained as a coach because I thought I couldn't go back to being a doctor. And the work that I did through becoming a coach, particularly including trigger tracking, so this idea of, you know, noticing before your immediate response, noticing what's happening with you and why you're responding like that, has made a massive difference in all areas of my life. So it's enabled me to actually enjoy my work again, to remember why I went into general practice in the first place, to notice all that. There are so many positives to it as a job that, you know, I've got a fantastic team of people I work with. We do really important work. It's very fulfilling. It's reasonably autonomous. It ticks so many boxes that just kind of got lost because I was so triggered all the time. Being able to take that pause and look after myself better so that when somebody says something that hits me in a way that reminds me of the way my mum or my dad used to speak to me, I can recognize it as, oh, hang on, this is me responding to something from a long time ago. This is not actually anything about the fact that Emma's asked me to do an extra session. It's not about the nurse knocking on the door to look at an ECG.
Yeah, and that has those ripple effects then, doesn't it? Because you're then, it's not triggering you to respond in a less helpful way. And that then helps support then the people who are kind of just happen to be there triggering those things, but who aren't at fault themselves necessarily.
Yeah, absolutely. And it allowed me to go back to being the kind of doctor I wanted to be, which is someone who people can come to with whatever concerns they have. I want to be a supportive trainer and a supportive colleague and senior colleague really to other people in the practice. I feel very strongly that we have a responsibility to train the people coming up after us to, yeah, to and not just to train them in terms of clinical work, but also in how to survive in what is a very difficult situation. So that's a lot of what I try to do as a coach, really, I think, is be really. And the other thing I think is that nobody, certainly in 2019, very few people were talking about burnout. So you did kind of think, oh, it's just me, everyone else is coping. So I make a real point of talking about how I feel. So if I'm feeling really tired and a bit cranky, I will say so. And I think previously I wouldn't even have noticed. It would have been somebody else's fault. It would have been just what was expected, and now I can go to one of my nurse colleagues and say, could you just give me a sense check on this? Am I being unreasonable? I can ask one of my colleagues, am I being, is this an unacceptable thing that the hospital are asking us to do, for instance, or am I just in a really cranky mood and a bit triggered by it? Because it And that's been really helpful, and it's also allowed other people to open up and ask the same sorts of things and notice the same sorts of things.
Yeah, because I guess if they see you doing it, then it gives them permission for them to be able to do it.
I hope so. That's certainly my plan. Yeah, that's my intention behind it. I think there's an imperative, a moral imperative on those of us who are at a level where we're not untouchable, but we're less likely to come to problems for standing up against things that aren't right.
Yeah. Are there many doctors who go through burnout and return back to practice, do you
That's a
think?
really good question, and I don't know. It's interesting because I gave a talk with a colleague of mine who's a vascular surgeon at the Royal College of GPs. Last year, about this, about sort of burnout and superwoman and doing things differently. And that was the main comment a lot of people had when they came up to talk to me afterwards was, so you're back in practice, you're still in the same place. A lot of people, I think, move to different roles or cut their hours or step back from positions of responsibility. It's such a horrible feeling. You don't want to go back to it, you really. And for several years, that was my main issue. I was extremely boundaried. I didn't take on anything extra because I couldn't bear the thought of going back to where I was in 2019.
And did you have the support of your
I did.
colleagues around you to be able to do that? Because I guess
That's a big thing, yeah.
that's the key thing, isn't it? Is getting other people on board so that you can come back in a boundaried way, which you need to in order to sort of continue the recovery from burnout.
Yes, yeah, and that is such an important point, and I guess that's maybe partly what I'm trying to do. So I heard one of the kind of leading, she's an ex-GP coach, she now runs sort of well-being courses and things for GP. She's fantastic. Her name's Rachel Morris, but she did a fabulous talk about air cover. So this idea that yes, you have boundaries, but if no one else is supporting your boundaries, you just it doesn't work. So you need, and I think my practice has been fantastic at this, and I don't think all practices are this fantastic, to be honest. When I went back on shorter hours. I didn't do any on-call for a year. I didn't get asked to do any extra for a year. And it was very much, when I felt able, I would take on a little bit different extra work, a little bit something else. But not before. And I think quite often in my experience of talking to other people who burn out, it's kind of right, you've had your time off, here's your full clinic, back to it. And that's, yeah, I mean, that, which is literally just jumping back in the boiling pan of water. And who wants to do that? And the thing I would say is, so I burnt out in 2019, so what are we now, 2024? I wouldn't, if I'd had to go straight back into what I'd left, I wouldn't still be working. I know that for a fact.
So important to kind of view that long-term objective, isn't it, to be able to make it a sustainable return to work rather than just, as you say, throwing back into the pan of boiling water.
And it's
But
hard, I think, if everyone else is up against it. It is really hard. So I am incredibly grateful to my colleagues who did hold that space for me. And I hope that I'm repaying that faith that they had now. And
yeah, I was just going to ask you about that kind of how did it feel? Because as someone in the medical profession, as a GP, I would imagine that you have this sort of huge sense of responsibility to your patients, to your colleagues, and to know and to accept that support and that they are holding space and sort of carrying things for you whilst you can recover. That must have been a challenging thing to do.
yeah, it's very hard, very, and I think I was very lucky in that my practice manager is very, not just supportive, but also very vocally supportive. And my other partners, several of them, were also very vocally supportive. So I wasn't kind of sitting in meetings having to, think, mind read about what they were thinking about me. And because I think that's one of the things we all tend to do, isn't it? We think we know what everyone else is thinking. But there were people who were very vocally on my side and outwardly supportive of, we don't want you to be on call until you're ready to be on call, and that sort of thing. Which I guess is what I'm now trying to do. I'm trying to be that support to say, yes, it's okay. And it's interesting, isn't it? I think one of the things which was really heartening was to feel the positivity when I went back, that people were really glad to have me back. My patients were happy to see me. My colleagues were happy that I was back, even if I wasn't doing what I used to do. And I think it was the therapy and the coaching that I had that allowed me to receive that, where I think previously it had probably always been there. But I hadn't been able to see it, hadn't been able to let it land, I guess.
And I think when you're in that sort of stage, I mean, thankfully I've never experienced burnout, but I suspect I have come fairly close to it at times. I've definitely had periods of my life where I felt, very overwhelmed by things. And when you're in that overwhelmed state, that you don't know what you're feeling almost, do you? Because you've kind of numbed out to it. So then you can't recognize that there is support out there, or because you're just sort of almost shut off from feelings, from sensations, from being able to rationally look at what other people are doing.
And I think even not just rationally, but in a kind of body wisdom sense, you have ignored what your body has been telling you for so long. I mean, I had rashes and sore throats and felt sick on my way into work every day and had terrible migraines, and I'd just kind of, right, push on through, until eventually my body just went, no, this is, this is not something that we can carry on with. But by closing off from all those, this is bad, you shouldn't be doing this messages, you also close off from the nurse whose smile lights up when it's you who's doing the clinic with them, the doctor who's really happy to be on call with you, the all of the positive stuff, the patients who are grateful, so who walk into the room one way and walk out like a load's been lifted off their shoulders, or whatever it might be, all of that's gone as well. So all of the things that make the job fulfilling and enjoyable and worthwhile and what you went into it for, they're not available to you either. They're all kind of locked away from you.
Yeah, I get it's almost like a focus. It just becomes a very narrow focus, doesn't it? So it because you have to shut off and protect yourself from all the negative side of it, you also end up shutting off from those positive things, and it just becomes a really almost like a narrow focus of existence, of just getting through, of surviving.
Absolutely, yeah, I think that's exactly it. Just get through the next thing and the next thing and the next thing.
I always think one of my favorite sayings or sort of takes is that you have to, in order to experience great joy, you have to also be able to experience great sorrow. So I suppose that kind of speaks to that, doesn't it? That kind of to be able to experience that whole breadth of emotion, you know, you've got to take the rough with the smooth.
Yeah, you don't get to pick, do you? You can't, yeah, I'll have those ones, but not those ones.
Yeah. So in the work that you're doing to support others, what sorts of things are you doing?
It depends, and it's very, I do one-to-one work is mostly what I've been doing. And so that's obviously quite tailored to the individual. Interestingly, most of the people I've worked with so far have come from similar families to mine. Quite a lot of work, and that's not necessarily planned. They just seem to be the people who come to work with me, which is lovely.
Yeah, why is, or sort of what is that
So
parallel, do you think?
I think there's a lot of us in public service. So I've coached teachers, I've spoken to police officers who are in similar sort of come from similar families, vets, but lots and lots and lots of people in the health service, because we're kind of a bit like I was saying before, we're kind of trained from a really early age that you don't matter, the role matters, how you. There's often this thing about how other people will view you. So, like, my mum was really proud to say I was a doctor and my sister was a police officer and my other sister's a teacher. So, very much roles.
Yeah, yeah.
And roles that generally people. The general public think are positive, worthwhile,
Yes,
role
that sort of good, upstanding member of the
right.
society, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And the more I look into it, the more I think actually my mum being able to say Caroline's a doctor meant she didn't actually have to know anything about me, because doctor is a thing, it's an archetype,
Yeah.
it's a everybody knows a doctor and has an idea in their mind of what a doctor means. So whether I don't know, whether I liked going on holiday to the beach or I liked go climbing up a mountain, didn't matter, because I'm a doctor and I fit in that box and everybody knows. So yeah, so there's that element, which I think comes through quite a lot, this kind of enormous family pride in what other people will think of you, which you also kind of carry because you've locked all these bits of yourself off and hidden them away in a box until I'm a doctor or I'm a vet or I'm a police officer is all you've got left as your self image as well. So I see a lot of that. A lot of your needs don't matter. Often with if you have emotionally immature parents, their needs are everything. And as a child, you're expected to essentially to take, there's a sort of parentificate emotional parentification where in a healthy, emotionally mature parent-child relationship, it's the parents' jobs to teach their children about emotions and teach them how to regulate themselves and co-regulate with them and all that sort of thing. And in an emotionally mature parent-child relationship, it goes the other way, and the child is expected to pay enormous attention to how the parent is and placate them and make sure they don't get upset and things like that.
Which is a huge burden of responsibility, isn't it?
Massive, massive. But then if you think about when you then go into nursing or medicine or whatever, it's all about the patient. It's all about
Yeah.
what looking out for the tiniest little cues of emotional shifts they have so that you can pick them up and figure out what's going on with them, and very little expectation that you give anything of your inner self back. So
Or
we've
that you're
got
necess or you're even recognized as a as almost as a human being. You
absolutely,
are
yeah.
doctor, nurse, police officer, whatever. Yeah, and actually perhaps not even seeing that there's a human being behind that role.
And I think that's then enforced through training and well, yeah, and qualifications and things like that. I heard medical school described as boot camp once, and I think that's true. I think it is a boot camp essentially. It's sort of break. It's that exactly the same, break you down and then build you up with all the same people around
Yeah.
you. So it's just kind of a pattern that goes through the whole of medicine, and that there's reports, you know, of people not being able, doctors not allowed to have a drink on the ward because it's not, patients shouldn't see doctors drinking, or having nowhere to put your stuff, having no, just all these dehumanizing things
Yeah.
essentially. But we're, I think as adult children of emotionally mature parents, we're set up for that. That's what we were trained in as children. So we're very easy to drop into the boot camp of med school or nursing school, and we're like, okay, yeah, this is fair enough. There's no chairs for all the doctors at induction. I'll sit on a bin, I'll sit on the floor. And you think, actually, that's not a way to treat
No.
professionals that you know want to have a lot of work from. There's no value there.
Sustainable just comes to mind.
Yeah. And I think again, it's been that kind of boiling water thing. So when I qualified, I'm old now, I qualified like 25 years ago. I think it was hard. Being a junior doctor was hard, but we had accommodation, we had a team, we got fed 3 times a week. So there was really hard work, but there were real rewards to it. And the rewards have essentially been sort of chipped away at. And I think this is partly why there's so much dispute in the NHS currently. A lot of the junior doctors are, instead of like me, I came in and the water slowly got hotter and hotter and hotter. The juniors are being plopped into boiling hot water and going,
Yeah.
yeah, no thanks. I'm going to go somewhere where they appreciate me.
I mean, obviously you're helping people on a one-to-one basis is beating the drum on a wider basis, something that you would ever want to do. Or sorry, I feel like I'm kind of leading you there and I don't mean to, but it just kind of struck me that it's fantastic that that you're doing the work with individuals on a one-to-one basis. But when you start to look at like the wider, I suppose the strategy of it is just wrong.
Yeah, so it's interesting because, yes, I feel like I've recovered from my burnout now. I feel, saying this to a friend recently, I feel more like myself than I have done since I was at school. So
Wow.
yeah, and some of the stuff that I'm doing, because I've managed to open those boxes and go, oh, actually, I don't mind talking, I don't mind visibility, I don't mind putting myself forward for stuff. I have been elected to a seat on the BMA's GP committee, which not 2019, Caroline, couldn't even have imagined, but
Yeah.
I'm loving it. I've put myself forward and been elected to our local medical committee. I'm going to go and talk to one of our MPs about the funding for general practice. And it is, yeah, absolutely. So the one-to-one work I love doing, but I see it very much as sort of ripples.
Yeah.
Hopefully will then ripple out further, but we need systemic change.
Yes. So out of all of this, what would you say has been the biggest lesson that you've learned from that sort of loss of, gosh, loss of health during the burnout, but also going back further, kind of almost loss of being able to be yourself, loss of your identity right back early on as a child.
I think that's the biggest thing. I think the biggest thing I've learned is that I'm okay, that I can open those boxes and show them to people and not die. Nothing. And even sometimes people go, oh, that's interesting. And I think a lot of it, I think, is about finding the people it's safe to do that with. It's safe to just break out a box and go, oh, look what's in here, and know that they will not tell you to shove it back in the box and put it away, nobody's interested, kind of thing. So that kind of network building has been really, really important. And the more I do that, the more I feel like I'm just expanding and expanding and expanding. It's really exciting. But yes, it's okay to be yourself, even if you're a doctor, even if you're a teacher, even if you fit into one of these roles. Find the people who are interested in all of you.
Yeah, and in finding those people, you're taking your ripples with you because they see you being able to be you and being feeling safe to be able to speak out, and then hopefully that gives them the courage or the permission or the inspiration to be able to do that to themselves, and so the ripples go
Yeah.
on and on.
And there's just something really powerful in speaking your truth, even if it's not the truth. Even if it's just to one person, just to a therapist, just to a close friend, just to your journal, just taking it out of that box that's sort of shoved down deep is really powerful and healing.
Yeah.
You know how they talk about your lowest point is often an enormous learning point. That it certainly was for me, has been. I
Yeah.
wouldn't be doing the things I'm doing now if I hadn't hit rock bottom. I'd still be trundling along from one bit of leaf to the next.
Thank goodness you have the support as well from the
Yeah,
those
huge.
networks around you at work and therapist, and I mean, see it in your face, you look so alive and vibrant. It's lovely.
Really interesting. Like I talked to someone who met me at the beginning of my Lead the Change journey, and she said exactly the same thing. You were so shut off before, and I thought I was really, hiding it well, but apparently I was not. And she said, like, now you're a completely different person. You look got this kind of spark in you. I'm like,
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's definitely a sparkle about you. It's lovely.
thank you.
Well, on behalf of like the general public at large, I'm so glad that you have been able to do all this recovery and come back to your work as a GP, and within that, obviously helping your patients, your colleagues, but also fantastic to hear about that wider sort of work that you're doing to hopefully start to make some changes at those real sort of grassroots, systemic level that needs to happen. And it's you being able to share your story on this podcast, on all the other platforms that you're able to talk on, that it offers inspiration, hope, and just that sort of sense of, yeah, do you know what? She's done it, maybe I can do it. And it's fantastic. So thank you so much for sharing that today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to share. It's a big part of my mission to share it.
Excellent. So if people are interested and would like to find out more about your work, how can they get in contact with you?
My company, the coaching company, is holistelic.co.uk, which I think I'll give you, and you can put in the show notes.
Yeah, sure.
There's a link there to book a conversation with me. I'm Holistelic on pretty much everywhere, so LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, I think all of them, you can find me there. Yeah, really happy to talk to anybody about any of this stuff.
Oh, brilliant. Oh, well, thank you so much for your time, Caroline, and keep up the great work that you're doing.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. It's lovely to talk to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Caroline. That was a great conversation. If you'd like more information about Caroline's work, then please do get in touch with her. The details are in the show notes. Thank you to everyone who supports me in the production of this podcast, to Jamie Farrell for the beautiful music, and of course to you for listening. Take care, and I'll be back soon with another lesson from loss.